this week on Behind the Lens. KIPP New Orleans will take over the charter for John F. Kennedy High School after a grading and transcript scandal that affected more than half of the senior class. Marta Jusen has the details. Also, a candidate for the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education survives a court challenge, securing her spot on the October ballot. And a new interpretation of the city's zoning laws threatens live music in restaurants and bars with outdoor space. Michael Isaac Stein explains. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
The Orleans Parish School Board made a quick decision, announcing Thursday that KIPP New Orleans would take over the charter for John F. Kennedy High School. KIPP reached out to Superintendent Henderson Lewis just 1 week after New Beginnings announced it would surrender the charter. I sat down with Marta Jusen, education reporter for The Lens, who has been following this story from the beginning. Marta, where does KIPP fall in the big picture of New Orleans' charter system regarding size and performance of the schools in their network?
KIPP New Orleans is one of the biggest networks in the city. They run 7 schools right now. They were the first charter group in the Recovery School District to have a school that earned an A. That was KIPP Renaissance, which has now been renamed Frederick Douglass High School, I believe. And they have a lot of other schools that are kind of middle of the road and that are C-rated.
Overall, do they have a good reputation as far as the way they run their schools?
I would say nationally, KIPP has a fairly decent reputation. They have definitely come under scrutiny for kind of their no excuses policy and a little bit of stricter discipline policies. But, I haven't really heard a lot about that recently in the city.
So generally speaking, what's the process in New Orleans of transferring a school from one charter organization to another?
Sure. So this is obviously something that happens quite frequently here. We see a lot of school closures, a lot of what the district, like you said, calls school transformations. That's when one charter operator leaves a school and another one picks up and the same students stay there. So that's what's going to happen at Kennedy and likely at Cap Dow too. So what will happen, and this is probably going to be a little bit of a different transition at Kennedy though, is that KIPP will come in and they'll start working with the New Beginnings folks, and they, I think, are going to have a much longer overlap than any other transitions in history, because normally what happens is a charter school closes in May or June. Over that summer is when parents start talking to the new charter group, and the new charter group comes in, and then things are being run a different way. Part of this handoff process is there's a lot of information to pass along. You certainly want to make sure you understand what kids' courses look like, what they've taken, what their grades are, what were their absences. And you just want to ensure that you really understand the data that's coming from the first school and going to the second school.
Right, because these schools don't necessarily, obviously they're all supposed to fulfill state requirements for education, but they don't necessarily have the same curriculum, do they?
Right. Charter schools get to pick their own curriculum, so they could be coming in instituting a totally new curriculum. I think that's obviously something that new charter operators have to evaluate when they come in to see if these kids that have not been operating on their curriculum are going to be able to pick it up right away or what they need to do to transition into that.
How does this work if there is more than one charter organization that's interested in taking over a school?
What the district has done in recent years is they've kind of done an open call for applications. Anyone can apply to take over a charter school. And then the district will evaluate, all the charter operators will meet with parents and staff and families. They kind of will, make a pitch to the families, and the families don't have any formal role in the decision-making process, but I know Superintendent Lewis can take under advisement, what they think if he wants, obviously, but it does all come down to his recommendation. And even his recommendation stands unless the school board overrides it. So the school board doesn't actually vote on this unless they want to overturn his decision.
So this really is quite a process. And in addition to this process, Kennedy parents have been through a lot in the past couple of months. What has KIPP said to address any fears and uncertainty that these parents and families might have about the future?
KIPP has certainly come in strong and said, look, we want to help you guys out. We're here for you throughout this year. They've already said they would offer resources, and it sounds maybe like potentially teachers or just, other things that they have to help students right now at Kennedy. KIPP has told me that they've met with parents. those aren't meetings that the public is invited to, so we have not been attending them, but I'm sure they're being very reassuring about at those meetings based on what I've read in letters and various other public documents that I've been able to see.
And what is KIPP potentially walking into here?
I mean, I think Kennedy is something that, you know, we've never really seen before, so they are going to be looking at student transcripts, and I don't know if they're necessarily going to know if they're accurate, because it hasn't really seemed like Kennedy has known if they're accurate. So I think one thing the district wants to do is announce these new operators before school enrollment opens in the fall, which usually opens in October or November. And that also would allow the new operator to begin working with the schools earlier. And so especially in the case of Kennedy, that would be very important for them to be able to figure out what exactly students have had and what they still need to graduate.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's really going to be a lot that needs to be figured out if students don't have accurate transcripts, they don't have accurate credits. If a new school comes in and has to figure out what the curriculum was and how it jives with their curriculum, it sounds like a really big undertaking.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to undertake there. And another interesting thing I'm just thinking of here and want to point out is that when you take over a school, you actually get kind of two freebie years where you're not graded. So that's interesting. You know, while it may seem and be very noble for KIPP to come and take over, they're not going to be immediately graded on the Kennedy students. Hopefully, I would say for the public and transparency's sake, that all that data is still going to be made available about graduation rates, and we're still able to see kind of what the fallout from Kennedy was management-wise, because I think those kids deserve to know. But it's not going to count against a new operator.
So Kennedy High School itself will not have a grade on school performance for 2 years.
Correct. They'll get a letter grade of a T, which stands for transition.
And so those grades are given by the Louisiana Department of Education. Why does the Department of Education give this 2-year grace period after a transition?
I think it's definitely an incentive for new charter operators to come in. Generally, in these situations, a school is being closed or turned over because it's a failing school. And so if you're a charter operator that has a relatively good reputation, you know, it's pretty high stakes to come in and take over a failing school or a school that has a lot of problems if you don't kind of have this incentive of a few years to clean things up and, you know, get things turned around.
Well, as we have said every time with this story, we will see what happens next. Marta Jusen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kira Orange-Jones is running for re-election to the State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, but her candidacy came under a legal challenge, questioning whether she had filed tax returns prior to qualifying for the election. Marta Jusen was at the court this week, and she joins me with the details. Marta, who is Kira Orange-Jones?
Kira Orange-Jones is a representative for the Orleans Parish and some surrounding areas on the state's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. That's the state board that oversees education, oversees the Louisiana Department of Education. And there are a number of elected representatives, and then there are some who are appointed by the governor. So she has been representing Orleans Parish and nearby areas for the last 8 years. She's now seeking a third term. She is in a leadership role with Teach for America, and has been for several years. So she continues to do this work on the board while she works for Teach for America.
And Teach for America is a program that came in to New Orleans really strong after Katrina, right?
Right. So Teach for America is a program that kind of does a quick turn training of teachers. These are people who have bachelor's degrees in other areas. They go to a summer institute and then they get teaching credentials in a certain capacity and are allowed to teach in classrooms. They've been in New Orleans for, I want to say, a couple decades, but certainly had a stronger presence after Katrina when the teachers union went away and all the employees of the Orleans Parish School Board were fired because there were no jobs anymore. And so that program is a bit controversial here because it has been seen as replacing, taking jobs from locals and replacing them with people, you know, young college students who have come out of the West Coast or East Coast or the Midwest and have come and moved in and are taking other people's jobs. And so Teach for America is really seen as a strong part of the education reform movement. You know, that's a big part of what Kira has worked on in the past. In fact, it actually caused issues for her at first because the Louisiana Department of Education had its own contract with Teach for America to hire teachers. and people mounted a challenge to her candidacy or her ability to be on the board and oversee that contract as an employee for Teach for America. That kind of fizzled away when Teach for America stopped signing contracts with the State Department of Education, and now the company signs contracts with individual schools and districts.
So as you said, Kira Orange Jones is planning to run again for BESSE, the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, but there was a legal challenge to her filing for candidacy. What happened?
So Linnell Steeb is a resident of Kira's district, and she's the one who filed this suit seeking to have Kira dismissed from the ballot. And she filed it on two different issues. She said that Kira Orange Jones had attested in her qualifying paperwork that she had filed 5 years of taxes, and Ms. Steeb believed that she had not filed her 2015 and 2017 taxes with the state. Additionally, Ms. Steeb thought that Ms. Jones had outstanding ethics board fees, and you're not allowed to run for office if you have outstanding fines. So those were the two things that she filed on. We go into court on Tuesday. The lawyers immediately agreed to dismiss the ethics fines. And then what played out over the next hour was a timeline of when and whether Kira had filed her 2015 and 2017 taxes on time. So there was a lot of back and forth. You know, what time was she at this office? What time was this paperwork stamped? When did she check the box on her qualifying paperwork and sign her name? And, you know, were her taxes filed before then or after then? Which led us down a path to, what is the definition of filed in Louisiana? And so Civil District Court Judge Christopher Bruno basically at one point said, okay, folks, we're taking a break. And he got up from the bench. He went back in his office, came back about 10 minutes later and is like, all right, I looked it up. Filed is postmarked when it's postmarked. So she had mailed her taxes on the 5th of August and then went and qualified on the 6th of August. So he deemed this not to be a problem. He said, you know, these challenges like this come up every year against people, and they're pretty routine, and most of them get dismissed rather quickly.
Did Linnell Steeb have reason to believe that Kira Orange Jones hadn't filed her taxes?
Yeah, so this was part of, I think, why it took so long to resolve this issue, is that Ms. Steeb had a letter dated August 8th that said the Department of Revenue could not confirm that Kira Orange Jones had filed her taxes in 2015 and 2017, those 2 years in question. So that led her to file the suit. When we get into court, we kind of work our way all the way back to that August 5th date when she says she mailed them, and then Judge Bruno going to figure out what is the actual definition of filed.
And the judge said something in court that you quoted in your article, Judge Bruno saying, quote, "The long and short of it is this language is gotcha language. Sometimes it gets you, sometimes it doesn't." What did he mean by that?
So he meant the word filed. He said, you know, guys, the word is filed. So I went and looked up the definition, and it's the date that it's postmarked. And so I think that's exactly what he meant, is like, you know, if she had sent it a day later, she would have got. But she didn't. She sent it on time.
Well, yeah, and for anybody who files their taxes, you know, we all know, I think, that if you file by mail, you have to have it postmarked by April 15th. It's not that it has to be received by the IRS or processed by the IRS. You were filed once it gets postmarked.
Right. So that was exactly what happened here, except we had worked backwards through all these steps of, oh, there's paperwork not confirming it. Oh, and someone else says it's being processed on a different day. And it turns out she had mailed them in time.
So what now? Is there any other controversy, or are there other issues surrounding Kira Orange Jones's candidacy for the BESSE board?
I think this is going to be a really interesting race. We have a lot of energy right now behind a group that is wanting to see schools go back to local control. And when they say local control, they don't just mean the Orleans Parish School Board. They mean that they want the district to run the schools instead of being an all-charter district like we are now. So there is one candidate kind of along those lines, Ashanta Wyatt, who has filed. She used to be the principal at Harney. She's running. And another woman, Shawan Bernard, is also running. So Orange Jones does have two challengers at this point. And then I think Kira Orange Jones has been a bit of a polarizing figure in the past with the Teach for America background, kind of versus that traditional schools versus ed reform arguments that's kind of always present in our city. Likely another part of this race is going to be that people are publicly questioning whether or not she lives in the district because her husband lives in New Mexico. And so there's kind of these conspiracy underground thoughts going around and swirling around, and she's changed addresses several times. She told me that she moved because her bathroom flooded. So I point blank asked her, you know, do you live in the district? And she said she does. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not that comes up as an issue in this race. We'll just have to wait and see what comes up in the coming weeks.
Marta, I'm sure you will keep us posted as this campaign continues. And the election, the Bessie election, along with the governor's election and other candidate elections on October 12th. Marta Jusen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A new interpretation of New Orleans' comprehensive zoning ordinance by the Department of Safety and Permits has led to questions over whether restaurants and bars with outdoor spaces can host live music. Michael Isaac Stein has been following the story and joined me by phone. Michael, you reported on an interpretation of zoning laws in the city that turned out to be pretty controversial. What happened?
So it just came up in the last month or so. The Department of Safety and Permits has interpreted the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance, which is basically the grouping of laws that govern zoning in the city of New Orleans. But they interpreted the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance to say that there can be no live outdoor entertainment as a secondary use anywhere in the city of New Orleans, except for in the French Quarter. But even in the French Quarter, you would need what's called a conditional use permit, so kind of an extra permission from the city to do that. And so basically what that means, a secondary use is when, you know, the business has another primary use. So here we're talking about a bar or a restaurant or a cafe. But basically what this ruling means is that a bar or a restaurant can't have outdoor music or readings or whatever it may be outside in a courtyard or a lawn or something like that.
Some of this had to do with language about doors and windows. Can you explain that?
In the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance, it basically sets out zoning rules for live entertainment, but it doesn't differentiate between indoor and outdoor live entertainment. So within the section that kind of governs live entertainment as a secondary use, one of the rules there is that you need to close your windows and doors when you have live entertainment. So the Department of Safety and Permits has interpreted that to mean, well, of course you can't have outdoor music, because then what would be the point of shutting your doors and windows in the first place if you could just, you know, have bands on the street outside or in your courtyard or whatever it may be. So that's kind of the section of the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance that they've used to make this new interpretation.
And, you know, noise ordinances in the city always seem to be really controversial. What has been the reaction from organizations like the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans that advocates for live music and culture bearers and restaurants in the area who make money off of hosting live music?
Right, yeah. So the Music and Culture Coalition, also known as MACANO, this is basically what they say is a reach by the Department of Safety and Permits, because as they read it, there are other sections of the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance that actually seem to allow outdoor live music. For example, there's one section that says in certain places, if you have outdoor live music, it needs to be 30 feet from, you know, any residential district. So for them, when they read certain parts of the ordinance that say that, they say, well, that kind of implies that as a baseline, you should be able to have outdoor music. And so that, you know, with this new interpretation, there are actual sections of the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance that basically become null and void because you can't have outdoor music anywhere. So if this new interpretation sticks, basically that existing businesses that have outdoor live music, they'll be able to continue doing so through what's called a non-conforming use status. And basically this allows businesses that are doing something that's restricted by the CZO, but they've been doing so before the restriction was put in place. But what MACANO argues is that over time, the non-conforming use status of these businesses is going to go away. So, for example, if you shut down your operation for 6 months, you lose your non-conforming use status. So, you know, one example is Oxalis in Bywater, and that's been shut down over 6 months now. So they have a courtyard whether it's, you know, dining and sometimes outdoor performances, they would have lost that non-conforming use status by now. So their argument is that although existing businesses should be able to continue operating as normal, in the long term, the number of places that will be allowed to have outdoor music will kind of just dwindle over time, and we'll be just seeing less and less outdoor shows.
Yeah, so that non-conforming status is really like a grandfather clause that businesses would be grandfathered into the previous interpretation of the rule. So how did this interpretation of the zoning laws first come out?
Right, so it actually has come up in two subsequent City Planning Commission meetings. I think when it really came to light was when the City Planning Commission was considering a motion brought forward by Councilmember Kristen Palmer that was looking to restrict outdoor dining and outdoor entertainment in historic districts within the Marigny, Treme, and Bywater. And basically, when the City Planning Commission staff came out with their report, what they said is, well, some of these restrictions on outdoor entertainment aren't fully necessary because of a recent interpretation by the Department of Safety and Permits. So for a lot of people, that was the first time they had ever heard of this interpretation. And, you know, we had talked to the department, and they actually couldn't even provide us with the written interpretation. They said they would try and dig it up and send it to us. That never happened. And that's a significant factor because Department of Safety and Permit interpretations can be appealed within 45 days of that interpretation coming down. But you can only appeal it if you can actually point to the place that the interpretation happened. And so right now, there is no official formal interpretation for people to appeal. So I think a lot of organizations and people, including Mackinac, are kind of right now looking to even find the official interpretation so that they can appeal it. But yeah, it came up in that case. It came up in another case, Central City Barbecue, which has this kind of outdoor gravel courtyard in its back where they'll have live music. They had kind of come forward with this proposal, this request for an amendment to the CZO, basically to make a new category of live entertainment. So it would kind of divide the category of indoor live entertainment and outdoor live entertainment. The City Planning Commission staff ended up basically recommending against that because in that request, it would have only applied to one specific district that Central City Barbecue is within. Basically what they said is that if they had granted that amendment change, only a few specific places in the city would be able to have outdoor live entertainment. And they kind of concluded that if this is an issue that the city wants to take up, the City Planning Commission would be open to that. But basically that this issue of Central City Barbecue specifically was too narrow to take up the issue of kind of the broader allowance of live outdoor entertainment in the city. So I think right now, both the City Planning Commission and perhaps the Department of Safety and Permits is looking for a way to clarify this law, but that would probably take an act of City Council asking the City Planning Commission to actually study this, study effects on surrounding neighborhoods and so forth.
Yeah, so what does happen now? One, is there anybody who is in favor of this new interpretation? And two, what does this mean going forward for the many musicians and venues in this town that host live music?
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear why the Department of Safety and Permits made this interpretation to begin with. You know, like I said, we still don't have the actual written interpretation. We don't know exactly when it happened, so we don't know what it was a response to. But speaking to officials at the Department of Safety and Permits, there is a clause in the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance that basically says that if there is a question, if there is some question of what a law means in the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance, that the Department of Safety and Permits has to take the most restrictive interpretation possible. So that's kind of what they were saying in terms of why they came out with the decision they came out with. In terms of next steps, the first would be that when a written interpretation does eventually come out, that is open to appeal. So it's open to appeal by maybe an organization like Mackinac or a restaurant that's going to be affected by this. So that could be one thing that we see going forward. Another could be that this might just be a wake-up call for the city. It might just be that this is kind of showing that there is a flaw in the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance, that they did not split up, you know, who's allowed to have indoor live entertainment versus outdoor live entertainment, you know, when this was written. So this might be a chance for the city council to kind of take this issue up and try and clarify these laws. And in terms of what it means for the city's musicians, you know, like we talked about, a lot of the venues that are already doing this, at least for now, will be able to continue if they apply for non-conforming use status. I think the issue, again, will be over time when these businesses start to close. It will also depend on how much the Department of Safety and Permits decides to clamp down on new businesses that maybe weren't grandfathered in. So I think that's all a matter of time.
So the immediate impact is nobody will be shut down. Musicians will still be able to play, and restaurants and bars will still be able to host them. We'll see what happens in the coming months. Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be off next week. In the meantime, please consider supporting independent journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org and make a donation today.